from the Threat Lab, the Department of Defense Counter Insider Threat Program, and the National Insider Threat Task Force, this is Voices from the SBS Summit.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Voices from the SBS Summit. I'm Katina Smith, an industrial organizational psychologist with the Threat Lab. And today, we're talking to Perry Wu, a retired assistant special agent in charge with Homeland Security Investigations and a fellow member of the Threat Lab. We'll be discussing post-traumatic stress syndrome and the stigma associated with it in military and law enforcement culture and how this relates to counter-insider threat programs and workforce protection.
Perry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Perry, you're a retired special agent with a career that's spanning 25 years. In that time, you had time to do a master's degree in public administration from DePaul University, and you led and supervised operations in some of the most highly populated cities of Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. While you were there, I see that you did some investigations into financial crimes, narcotics, cyber crimes, computer forensics, crimes against children, and undercover operations. And it looks like it's all domestic and international environments.
That's correct.
So the reason you're here today, can you tell us a little bit about what happened to you on February 16th, 2012?
Thanks, Katina. On February 16th, 2012, I was involved in a deadly workplace violence incident at the Long Beach Federal Building and had to take lethal action against another special agent who had just shot our boss. I immediately entered the dark world of post-traumatic stress symptoms, PTSS, formerly known as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. So for the past 9 years, I've been actively sharing my story of emotional survival, resiliency, and self-care, and also urging organizations to develop peer support teams for PTSS survivors. Now, while PTSS is commonly associated with our U.S. military, law enforcement officers, however, do face similar life-threatening challenges, and research supports it.
Tell us a little bit about some of those challenges that are similar between the military and the law enforcement.
Sure. Military and law enforcement officers have one thing in common, and that is addressing any type of threats on America so U.S. citizens and residents here don't have to. While military primarily fights on the foreign battlefield, the boots on the ground, law enforcement officers here in America, we are fighting our own domestic battlefield. Now, both jobs can be physically and psychologically demanding, where the operator or the officer experiences a cycle of peace that quickly escalates to deadly violence. And it's through this ever-changing cycle that oftentimes there can be psychological damage. Now, with daily exposure to confrontations, physical violence, injury, or death, I can tell you that in my 25-year law enforcement career, I've served over 300 high-risk federal arrest and state search warrants and have responded to shootings, homicides, and gruesome accidents. So the daily exposure to that, it's something that becomes seared into your mind, into your psyche. Both military and law enforcement officers, are forced to make split-second decisions during a time of battle or conflict, and that could be the meaning and the difference between life and death. So it's with this exposure to repeated violence, threats, and trauma on a repeated basis that can lead to mental health challenges if not properly treated, which can also result in emotional numbing, desensitization, disgruntledness, suicide. But for the purposes of this podcast, military and law enforcement officers can also be high risk for insider threats.
So they're higher risk to become insider threats. What makes you say that?
Well, there are at least four reasons why military and law enforcement personnel pose unique insider threat risks. One, these members have authority. So that could be either a law enforcement badge, a military ID, police or military uniform, or access to government vehicles. This authority can also be shown because these members possess security clearances, so they have current access to law enforcement military databases and restricted information. These members also have physical access to restricted areas such as the Pentagon, the CIA, and as we saw in the Navy Yard shooting, the contractor had access through a key card and that allowed him to get into the Navy Yard to conduct his shooting.
You're talking about Aaron Alexis in 2013?
Yes, the 2013 Navy Yard shooting where he killed 12 members of the Navy Yard team. The second area that gives the military and law enforcement a unique perspective is they carry weapons. Many of them carry it either on base as a military police officer or as a current law enforcement officer. So they have access to ballistic vests, ammunition, and other means to cause harm. The third factor would be specialized training that the military and law enforcement have. They have training in the use of firearms, explosives, but also counter surveillance and counter intelligence training, and also undercover training. So these individuals are masters of obtaining information without leaving any footprints or any paper trails.
I can see how that would be very, very advantageous if a person was going to be an insider threat.
Precisely. And the fourth and final reason is the military and law enforcement are trained in deception and manipulation. So these are individuals who know how to interface with people. They know how to interview and obtain and extract information from various sources, such as other government law enforcement analysts or informants.
That's a pretty impressive and serious list. So given that information, this is a sensitive and a unique group. I'm thinking about what your experiences are with, you know, the fact that you have PTSS, the experience that you had in 2012. So in the military and police environments, what have you found to be the attitude about mental health issues with PTSS or other types of situations where a person experiences trauma?
I'd like to first break down post-traumatic stress syndrome and just that a little bit of that evolution and research. And then we'll get into the sort of the attitudes in the organizations. But post-traumatic stress symptoms often is referred to as the invisible wound. These are the scars that you cannot see, and these are the scars that often hurt the most. In World War I, a British psychologist named Charles Samuel Myers coined the phrase shell-shocked to reference soldiers' reactions to bombardment, fighting, trench warfare, which produced an appearance of panic, fright, flight, or the inability to sleep, walk, or talk, also known as the thousand-yard stare. And after World War II, the phrase shifted into a combat or battle fatigue. And it wasn't until 1970 that the term post-traumatic stress disorder was identified during a U.S. military study of its Vietnam veterans. In 1980, the PTSD terminology was officially recognized by the American Psychiatric Association and documented in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-3. The DSM-5 identifies PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as a diagnosable disorder brought on by exposure to severe, usually life-threatening events and causes considerable disruptions in thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that last greater than 1 month. From the traumatic incident, day one to day 30, that's clinically diagnosed as acute stress disorder. And currently, the U.S. military refers to PTSS as combat stress reaction. Now, while I was not in the military, I do have a lot of friends in the military and who I interface with quite often. And the agreement is that in military and law enforcement, the media often portrays our profession as sort of sort of in emotionless macho action heroes, as depicted in the movies Rambo and Die Hard. It shows an individual who is proficient in doing their job, but after they may have to kill somebody, there's essentially, you know, there's no reaction, they're stone cold. In law enforcement in particular, police don't like to show their emotions for fear of ridicule. I've seen supervisors tell another officer, agent, to toughen up, go home and have a beer. The feeling will eventually pass. And if counseling is sought, law enforcement peers may conclude that you are weak and unfit for duty. In my 25-year career, it was common to me that the law enforcement officer has essentially three fears concerning post-traumatic stress disorder and symptomology. And so therefore, with these three fears, the officer will be less likely to self-report mental health issues. And these three fears are the fear of management, the fear to be placed on a fit for duty assessment, to be demoted or terminated, or if management found out medication was being used that would directly violate each department's firearm policy, and the agent or officer would not be able to carry firearms, which, as you all know, is essential to conduct our work. The second fear is the reputation among peers. Nobody wants to be viewed on a search warrant as a coward, as a weakling, or somebody that cannot be counted on. And the third fear that officers, law enforcement officers face is the streets. It's the domestic battlefield that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. The fear of being killed in the line of duty, but also losing that fighter's competitive edge. So these are three fears that in my 25-year career was very prevalent amongst my peers. Now, there is a 2020 research featured in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, that was, the research was titled, What is Prevalent of Mental Health, Mental Illness, and Mental Health Care Use Among Police Officers at a Large Urban Police Department? So the findings of this research was a survey was conducted on 434 Dallas police officers, and 12% had lifetime mental health diagnoses, and 26% reported current symptoms of mental illness. Now, of these officers, 17% had sought mental health care services in the past 12 months, but overall, officers felt there were at least four barriers that prevented them from seeking mental health services. The four mental health barriers that officers in this research felt were: one, the inability to identify when they are experiencing mental illness. And this is the stress level that officers are so accustomed to dealing with a day-to-day basis that they looked at the stress and the trauma that they experience as the norm for us. They became numb to it, desensitized, that the threats are part of the job. The second barrier that officers felt in this research were confidentiality concerns, that if you speak to somebody, it is not really held in trust and that the information would be leaked throughout the department. The third barrier was belief that the psychologist or mental health professional could not relate to their occupation. And some phrases that they had expressed were, I don't need to talk to somebody that has no clue of what I'm trying to say. Unless it's somebody within the department, I don't want to talk to them. I don't want to talk to them. They don't get it. They don't know. They don't understand. And the fourth and final barrier is the stigma that officers who seek mental health services are not fit for duty. And some of the expressions there are, well, people that go there, they've got something wrong, or it's an issue they can't handle, so a sign of weakness. And there's also a reprisal if you go see a mental health professional, you're going to lose your job. I'm an officer. I should be able to take care of myself. I should be able to handle anything that's going on. And the conclusion of the findings were that routine mental health screening may be needed in law enforcement agencies to systemically identify and refer officers to mental health care services.
So, why do behaviors and attitudes about mental health treatment in the military and law enforcement matter so much in insider threat prevention?
Well, Katina, because the exposure to repeated violence and death on a regular basis can lead to serious mental health challenges, and if not treated, can result in emotional numbing, disgruntledness, suicide, or even insider threats. And of this population of military and law enforcement, there are at least four of why they become insider threats. The first reason is greed. They are able to provide information or conduct illegal activity based upon their security and their position. And we see this with the Robert Hansen FBI case. The second reason is for terrorism, domestic or foreign terrorism or religious extremism. And we saw that in the Fort Hood shooting with Nadal Hassan. The third reason could be a disgruntled employee, workplace violence, or sabotaging a company. And this was evident in my 2012 Long Beach police shooting. One of my employees tried to assassinate our boss. And during my intervention, I had to struggle for his weapon and eventually drew my weapon and fatally shot the employee, ending what could have been a deadly massacre. And the fourth reason is the overall dispute with the United States as a whole. And we saw that in the Oklahoma City bombing with Tim McVeigh, a former military member.
Since your incident and since 2012, and you've been seeking treatment yourself, have you witnessed a shift in attitudes and behaviors towards mental health or mental health treatment? Is there more or less stigma?
Yes. So in my discussions and upkeep with many of my military and law enforcement friends, yes, dramatic improvements, a changing paradigm that many of these barriers are taken down in a number of ways. So in law enforcement, there is greater acceptance of seeking mental health professionals. There are EAP professionals, trauma counselors that are available. And even certain types of investigations like undercover work and crimes against children, those often come with the opportunity to meet with a psychologist to make sure there's a wellness check on the investigator. After my shooting, before I was able to obtain long-term mental health care, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department offered me access to one of their onboard full-time clinical psychologists. And I was pleased to learn that the LA County Sheriff's Office has 14 full-time clinical psychologists on board to care for the staff of about 20,000 sheriff's deputies and support staff. So I found that to be a wonderful an example of an agency and the department taking care of their own.
That's very encouraging.
Also, yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. And there's also a greater acceptance to not only mental health professionals, but advanced mental health care, such as trauma therapy and a therapy called eye movement and desensitization and reprocessing, known as EMDR. And that was a privilege and honor to be able to have that trauma therapy with a Army doctor when I was stationed in Washington, D.C. So that was a wonderful advancement and just use of different forms of trauma therapy. The third area that I've seen a drastic improvement is the development of peer support programs. These are, again, in-house departmental support systems that are with your peer, fellow officers, agents, or soldiers. And this is where these are individuals who usually will know you the best or do the same job. So there's a mutual respect for one another. And these programs, as they get set up, provided a drastic improvement of the wellness, and no question in my mind, prevented many suicides through the peer support programs. In the military, great advancements there with the Wounded Warriors program, the Yellow Ribbon program for reintegration, and the VA hospital in particular. I'd like to share my dear friend, retired HSI agent and Iraq War Army veteran, Andy Mefford, retired, and he is now working as a licensed clinical social worker at the VA, serving military veterans in Houston, Texas. So very, very pleased to see those developments.
It's a lot of changes in a short period of time. Having gone through what you have and having witnessed these changes, what are some specific actions that organizations should and shouldn't do to lessen the stigma associated with seeking treatment for mental health issues, like what you experienced with PTSS and PTSD? And what can they do to promote resiliency, especially when it comes to jobs where there is a high likelihood an employee will experience some kind of traumatic event?
Yes, I think it's critical that military and law enforcement organizations and general organizations as a whole, that they really take an aggressive stance in addressing trauma with its members, but also in monitoring potential insider threats. And they can do that in a number of ways. The first way is to continue to invest in professional mental health care. I'd like to share with you that I am still seeing a licensed clinical psychologist. He is Dr. Robin Klein. He is a 30-year retired Long Beach police sergeant, and he retired and studied, and he is now the Long Beach Police Department's official police psychologist. And so I asked him to share his wisdom, which I'll share with you, and quote, "As a former police officer and now a police psychologist, my message to management would be this. Anytime you have an officer involved in a traumatic situation, mandate that they at least make contact with a professional who is knowledgeable about law enforcement and trusted to maintain confidentiality." And that speaks volumes to me, because one of the greatest things I appreciate about Dr. Klein is that, having done my job before, any type of stress that I can bring up related to law enforcement, he's already been there, done that. And now with his training, he's able to identify with me, and I have the trust and confidence in him to walk me through my recovery. And so that's an ongoing journey that I have with him every Wednesday. And I'm very honored and blessed to have his services. The second way that organizations can be aggressive with caring for its trauma members and also avoiding potential insider threats is creating peer support teams. And so that would consist, again, of a crisis response team, geographically being on call, but also peer counselors, people who have some sort of training who can sort of be that bridge and gap before long-term care is sought. It's being a friend to somebody in the field, and often that goes a long, long way. The third area is conduct manager sensitivity training. There are many managers who supervise, but they don't manage their personnel. And I think it's through that repeated pattern of an employee going through a traumatic event or going through a personal situation, and you're having a manager who just doesn't care. And I think these present additional triggers for the affected individual. And then if not managed properly, it can also lead to insider threats. The fourth area is training, job placement and development. And so these are forms of reintegration, whether it's a returning soldier from the battlefield or a beat officer who has worked a particularly dangerous beat and this officer is trying to recuperate or recover. So both of these individuals need to find assignments that don't cause additional triggers, they don't exacerbate their trauma, but it's also assignments that the employee themselves find useful and helpful for their career. They don't feel that they're sort of stonewalled or forced to go back into their traumatic incident on a day-to-day basis. The other area is administrative support. I know that going through my shooting, there were a lot of issues in terms of injuries, legals. So there were a lot of attention that I had to allocate while I was still addressing my unseen wounds. And so I think my encouragement to organizations is that they can develop a administrative support team that can help the affected service member or law enforcement officers handle any issues with disability, legal matters, representation, medical forms, temporary housing, or return from the field. I think if there was administrative support who can help the affected individual navigate through that process, that would it would take away a lot of triggers that unfortunately I had to deal with. And the last encouragement that I have is the most important, but it's actually the easiest, and that's to listen to your employees. This will give the affected member a chance to address any grievances, any concerns, any fears that will help them restore their dignity, their trust in the organization, the ability to heal and recover quickly, and also gain the motivation to know that the agency has their back. Don't be an additional trigger to the process that would lead these individuals to consider being an insider threat. And always remember, the scars that you can't see hurt the most.
Yeah. That's a lot of great information, Perry. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much, Bettina.
Don't miss out on our new products from the Threat Lab. Sign up for our distribution list at dodhra.threatlab@mail.mil. Stay tuned for the 2021 Counter Insider Threat Social and Behavioral Science Summit, launching on September 1st at sbssummit.com.